You are Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz.
Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
It is Locked On Jazz for the 11th of February. Happy birthday to my baby girl, who's now 14, which makes me back to the reoccurring theme of getting old. Jazz looked very good against the Spurs in a wacky, weird game. New lineup uses by Quinn Snyder we'll talk about. And this team seems to now never play. It's like day off after day off after day off. We'll talk about that, plus our Monday look at the Western Conference. It's all coming up on today's edition of Locked On Jazz. Pow! How are you? I'm David Locke, radio voice of the Utah Jazz, Jazz NBA insider. This is Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz, giving you insight, expertise, lots of geeky numbers. We'll certainly do that today. When you get in your car, you can tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Jazz. It's that simple. Just get in your car and tell your smart device, phone, say the keyword, and then play podcast Locked On Jazz. Kind of cool. All right, we're going to review the Spurs game. I told you what we're going to do already. Hope you had a nice weekend. It does feel like we aren't playing much, doesn't it? Like, I suddenly have time off and days off, and it's kind of wacky. I guess that's good, but it is definitely sort of wacky. And a tip of that to Lindsey Vonn, whose career wrapped up. I spent my weekend out at ski races, and those are, you know, my daughter's racing, and those are a bunch of girls that, as young kids, ran around wanting to be Lindsey Vonn. Probably never had a hero quite like it. Have Michaela now, but that is an impact one has left on the sports world. All right, let's walk through the really solid win on Saturday over the San Antonio Spurs by the Jazz. What a weird game. The Spurs opened the game in a triangle and two. They were face guarding Ingles, face guarding Donovan, and then playing the rest as a triangle and two. I do think there's something about that that it's just revealing as, you know, as we move forward of kind of what teams think of how to guard us, right? That was the extreme. That was Pop probably being a little bit of Pop. But that's pretty eye-opening that the feeling is we'll just stay in this triangle and two. Quinn adjusted pretty quickly, then started using some different lineups, and got the Spurs out of it. But it was certainly an interesting tactic by the Spurs and flustered the Jazz. And actually, I'll be honest, flustered me on my call a little bit in the sense that it was something I could tell something unusual was going on, but I couldn't tell what it was entirely. And so that kind of led, I was actually struggling a little bit on the broadcast to try to find and figure out what was taking place and why things were taking place the way they were, which, you know, just it's not a big deal, but you could just tell something was definitely different than what was anticipated or what you regularly see. So it's great. I think it was a really important game for Ricky Rubio, having not been traded, having everybody talked about Mike Conley for so long, including myself, not like everybody. And then to have a team basically not guard you, and yet you come out and make enough plays that you make them pay. And Quinn made, you know, two adjustments I thought were really impressive when the Spurs came out like that. One was he immediately went to Jay Crowder and Kyle Korver. We never saw Favors and Gobert play together again. And then the second was a quick move to basically playing a pick and roll in the middle of the floor while Donovan and Joe were being face guarded, or I think by that time it might have been Kyle, with Rubio with the ball in his hands and let him just make plays on a 3-on-3. Most NBA players, if you get them, you know, the fewer numbers you get, the better they become. And the bet, you know, if we played 4-on-4, the scoring would be through the roof. If we played 3-on-3, the scoring would be through the roof. So, and in turn, the Jazz had their fourth best offensive game of the year. So by the time it was said and done, and the Jazz have actually had a few really good offensive games recently. The Minnesota game on the – sorry, I had to – throat was tired. On the 27th of January, Minnesota game was the third best. Atlanta was the seventh best. Spurs is the fifth best. Defensively, we have not. We have not been our elite-level defense here for a little while. In fact, stem it back to when we started that sequence of Portland, Denver, Minnesota, Minnesota, Portland, Atlanta, Houston, Phoenix, San Antonio. The only two, the only three nights where we've been really great were Minnesota, Atlanta, and Phoenix. Otherwise, those numbers have been up a little bit. Pretty darn good against San Antonio, but right on our league, our season average. So the defense has not been quite as sharp. Some interesting shot distribution aspects to that game, both offensively and defensively. So the Jazz against a Spurs team that is an interesting group because they're analytically good offensively, or we see analytically good defensively and analytically terrible defensively, yet they're the third best shooting team. I mean, I think that there needs to be a little bit of a look at what they're doing as a team in the sense that they are simply just not taking contested threes. They turn those into some mid-range shots, and they somehow are coming out with an effective field goal percentage that's the third best because the threes they're taking, they're making. Now, what the Jazz did the other night is just swung shot distribution wildly in their favor. The Spurs took 12 shots at the rim all night. Now, both DeRozan and Aldridge go to the rim very rarely, and the Spurs go to the rim very rarely. But the presence of Rudy just dominated that. Then, the Jazz only allowed the Spurs to take 21 threes in that game. So, the Spurs took 48 mid-range shots. And they hit 41%, right about league average. The Jazz, on the other hand, got 28 shots at the rim, took their 21 mid-range shots, and took 36 threes. So we talk about the ideal shot distribution being 40-40-20. They were 40-37-23. Pretty good. And, again, 14 corner threes. What is going on there is incredible. According to the NBA numbers and clean the glass numbers are a little different, but where I said we've had some good offensive games, recently, go back to the, I mean, I don't even know where you start this trend. You can go back to January 11th against the Lakers. You can go back to 14th against Detroit. Or you can just start it more recently against Denver and Portland and Cleveland. 11 against Cleveland. I mean, actually, 7 and 8 corner threes is a lot in a game. Here's a long run. Ready? 14, 7, 14, 8, 8. Eight corner threes is 10% of your shots. The league leader in the league is right around there. Cleveland 11, Portland 9 against 16 corner threes against Denver, 11 against Minnesota, 16 against Minnesota, 9 against Portland, 18 against Atlanta, 16 corner threes against Houston, 10 corner threes against Phoenix, and 15 against San Antonio. We only hit 4 of 15. Are above the break three-point shooting, which had been really dormant, finally kicked in against San Antonio, which led to the third-best offensive night of the year. We hit 12 of 26. Now, in the recent games, we're still hovering around 32% there. But the corner, the ability right now for the offense to go get corner threes is really remarkable. And it's a tribute to Rudy's role. It's a tribute to the Jazz spacing. It's a tribute to them understanding ball movement. It's why the team's better offensively right now. You know, now you got to just make sure you got guys who can make corner threes. Right? Like, that's the next stage here is, and we're beginning to see that with Quinn, and we'll talk about it with lineups here in a minute. He's beginning to change some things. We'll walk through who shoots the corner three well, who doesn't. And look at a little bit of that, plus a little lineup adjustment Quinn's made, and a few more notes on that ball game against the Spurs if necessary before we look at the Western Conference. That's the plan for today's show. Remember, when you get in your car, tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Jazz or Locked On NBA, which is the other one that I'm often involved in. The only problem is I have to figure out what I'm doing for a Thursday Locked On NBA this week. I hadn't thought about that. That's a problem. Hey, I just thought about that right now, right this very second. What am I going to do about that? I'm going to San Francisco and LA for meetings when it all starts, so I'm not sure. That's that issue. All right, you don't really care about that. What you do care about is Utah. And what you want to make sure is that you love and care about our great state. And the way you do that is be making your water efficiency rating better. I want you guys, I want to hear your hacks. I want to hear your emails to me, dlock09@gmail.com, of ways in which you are becoming a water efficiency officer. So my latest is I use both a like Quip style toothbrush, and then I also use a Sonicare face thing. And I used to, be honest, I used to probably leave the water running a little bit. Now, get them wet, turn the water off. If you take a shower, and then it's 5 minutes instead of a tub, you go from 12 to 25 gallons to 70 instead of a tub that uses 70 gallons. The other thing is I have a Google Assistant in my bathroom. I now put a timer. When I jump in the shower, I tell it to set a timer to 3 minutes. Because for every minute you save your shower, you're saving an awful lot of water. These are all little ways you can do it. You can install a low-flow toilet by save 0.3 gallons per flush, which doesn't sound like a lot, but flushes do add up. For more on how to boost your WER, head to slowtheflow.org and share with me little tricks you have. Slow the flow, save H2O. Now let me let you hear from Spencer Nelson, who did a great job on our broadcast the other night on the Jazz broadcast, and the new company he's now working for. They're not new. He's newly working for them. Not that new, actually. Iron Gate Global Advisors. I'd like to introduce you to Iron Gate Global Advisors Financial Group out of Salt Lake City. I found out about them from Spencer Nelson, former Utah State Aggie, great basketball player. And beyond his jump shot, he's got an MBA. He's worked in private equity. He's got experience working in Wall Street, accounting and financing degrees. And he's now working with Iron Gate Financial. And here's why.
As I evaluated my options and looked at different firms, it became clear to me that the real question I needed to ask was, who would I trust managing my portfolio? And as I got to know Brett and I got to know Brian, I was able to see how they differentiate themselves from so many other wealth management firms and the real value that they create. And it was clear to me that I wanted to work with them.
Brian's a long-term financial expert. Brett, who's been in the business forever, has got an options background. They have a strategy, a direction, and a process. And most importantly, as a small firm, they understand your journey. If you'd like to find out more about Iron Gate, give Spencer a call at 888-591-0334. That's 888-591-0334 or email him at spencer@igga.com. Anytime we're talking investing, understand that past performance isn't indicative of future results. Also, options may not be for everyone. They have different risks. Make sure you consult a professional before doing anything with them. Do your due diligence. So who are our best three-point shooters? Corner three. The league average is probably an important number to get in here. I haven't checked. I don't know if it's usually goes up a little bit. As the year goes on all the shooting numbers usually go up. League average corner three is usually right around 38-39%. Last I checked this year, it was at 38%. The mid-range shot is up a little bit from a year ago, by the way. It's kind of an interesting little tidbit and note that teams are forcing, I think, teams off the three so much and everything else that it's forced people to take some more mid-range shots and make them, but it's still doesn't make it. There seems to be a loss going on a little bit in the narrative of it actually suddenly makes it a good shot. It's a shot you might have to make every now and then, but it's certainly not a shot that shouldn't dictate your day. The Warriors are the number one team in the league defending long twos. Like, I'm not sure that I think that's like a big meat thing I would be super proud of if I was the Warriors, if that makes sense. So our corner three shooters are Jay Crowder, 35%, Dante, 34%, Derek, 19%, Joe Ingles, 49% on corner threes, Donovan, 30%, he was 50% last year, George Niang, 35%. George Niang's a 45% above the break three-point shooter. Ricky Rubio, 37%, 31% on above the break. Tabo, 38%. Limited sample size. Howell, 36%. Kyle Korver, 46%. So Korver, 46%. Ingles, 49%. O'Neal, 41%. Rubio, 37%. That's pretty good. Got to avoid the Derek one at 19%. Don't want to, you know, once a night. Jay at 35 is okay. It's a little below league average. The league average is 38.5. It has gone up a tiny bit. If you're wondering, shooting in the restricted area is 63%. Both short twos, so non-restricted area in the paint, and mid-range shots are the exact same. That's incredible. 40.2%. Both of them the exact same. So non-restricted area two. All non-restricted area twos should be looked at as the same efficiency shot. It's what it's 0.8 points. The corner three is 38.5 or 1.15. And the above the break three is 35% or 1.04 points per shot. Think about that for a second, though. Every time you take a corner three instead of a mid-range shot, you are... your point per possession is up 0.35 points per possession. It is, you have to be so much better at, like, to not have that be the right choice is a, it's almost impossible. All threes are still somewhere around, there's four times more above the break threes taken than corner threes, just in general, by the way. So all threes are about 1.06, 1.07. Compared to 0.8 for mid-range. I mean, I can listen to everybody talk to me about the importance of mid-range and this and that. And, and they want to believe. There's no factual basis by which any of that actually holds any water. And frankly, like, not embracing it at this point seems silly. But we can move on. Interesting little note in that game from the Jazz was for the second straight game, Quinn Snyder used Royce O'Neal as a power forward. Tabo Sefolosha and George Niang both weren't really in the rotation. A little post-All-Star break tightening going on here, maybe. And if we look at our five-man lineups, again, we didn't play our starter. It's such a wacky thing to have your starters not play minutes. Because you go through all shoot-around predominantly with your starters, and then you don't play them very much. Our starters played 4.6 minutes together. A lineup of Neto, Korver, or Neto, Donovan, Korver, Royce O'Neal, and Ricky Ruby and Rudy Gobert. So O'Neal is the five. Sorry, Gobert is the four. O'Neal is the five. Was the most used lineup we had that night. And the offensive rating when they were on the floor was a 114. The defensive rating was 100. So super. The starting lineup. Then the other. The regular Jay Crowder lineup was its usual plus three. Starters were minus five. Then there was the lineup of Ricky Rubio, Donovan Mitchell, Joe Ingles, Royce O'Neal, Rudy Gobert that played 4 minutes and was plus five. You can actually just look, outscored him 14-9 in 4 minutes. And then there was the lineup of Ricky Rubio, Donovan Mitchell, Kyle Korver, Royce O'Neal, Rudy Gobert. That played 3.6 minutes. That actually got outscored. But there's a lot of Royce O'Neal 4 minutes here. So that's certainly interesting. And as Dante returns after the All-Star break, probably something we'll see even more and more. Or at least there's an attempt to it right now. When Royce played with Jay in his first stint, and then about a minute into his second stint, Jay Crowder went out, and so then Royce O'Neal checked in for Jay Crowder. Sorry, I had the wrong. So Royce O'Neal played the final 8:37 of the first half as the power forward. Jazz went on a 23-9 run in there. They were plus 14 in that 8:39. Now it helps when Royce hits all his shots. In the third quarter, Royce came in for Jay Crowder. They closed out the quarter on a minus 6. And then Jay Crowder and Royce O'Neal played together to close the ballgame until it was over. So really an interesting little twist and change to, and Neto's playing about 14 minutes a night. I would assume that that those become Dante minutes and then Dante chips into some others. Donovan played 39, which is probably a little more than you desire, but I'm not sure it really, not sure I buy all that, frankly. I don't know. I'd like to see if there's really true math on what's going on with that, frankly. Not sure I totally buy. You just look back over the years and the guys played a lot of minutes and a lot of them had long careers and I just am not sure I'm buying that the extra three, I'm buying the three games in four nights tires you out. I'm buying that four games in five nights is not great for you. I'm not entirely sure that I buy that 36 to 33 minutes matters. I actually just would like to see the science. I haven't seen it. That's really probably all you're hearing from me is I'd like to see the science. And I don't know that I've seen that science. And I'm not sure that science really exists. Some of this I actually think is like the old True Hoop group got on this whole fatigue thing and ended up pushing it across in a manner that got everyone to buy into it. As weird as that is. All right, let's take a status check on the Western Conference and look at all of those things as we continue on Locked On Jazz. By the way, we have a survey out. It takes some time. We are giving you a gift certificate or a drawing for a $250 Vivid Seats gift card. Go to LockedOnPodcasts.com/survey. LockedOnPodcasts.com/survey. It's pretty lengthy. If you have the time, can sit down and do it. Super appreciate it. Be just great if you could take the time. Lets us have a better understanding of what you want. Lets us have better communication with our clients. Lets us have better data to what we need to do to improve the shows. We sit around and debate all day long, all these different things about what we can do to make ourselves better. And then I don't know that we ever actually have any real data on it. So that'd be great. All right, let's take a look at how everybody looks around the Western Conference. I always like this. It's kind of the Monday check-in, last 10 games. Some of these numbers are skewed, but it gives you a little bit of an idea of where things are going. The one that happens when we do this each time is how great the offenses are. The Warriors' last 10 games, offense is a 119 per 100 possessions. So is Portland's, is at 118. The Thunder's, this is really interesting, they struggled so badly offensively, is at 117. They are 9-1 in their last 10. I have got to back off all my thoughts on that they're not legit. They're pretty great. Boston's offense is a 115.5, and their internal turmoil continues. Denver is the fifth best offense in the NBA. Philadelphia is sixth. San Antonio is seventh. Washington, without John Wall, not stunningly, because if you pay attention to points gained, that's clear, is eighth. We're the 12th best offense in the league. Defensively, Milwaukee, Indiana, 1-2. Memphis is the third best. Detroit is the fourth best, interestingly. Also, Eastern Conference teams playing Eastern Conference teams. And the Warriors is the fifth best. The Warriors have clicked in. We're 12th offensively over the last 10 games. Differential, Warriors 1, Thunder 2, Milwaukee 3, Raptors 4, Blazers 5. Blazers had a terrible loss this weekend. They lost in Dallas. They had one field goal for 10 minutes. They lost a 15-point fourth quarter lead. Boston 6, Philly 7, Utah 8. So from a differential standpoint, the Warriors, the Thunder, the Blazers, and the Jazz are the four best Western Conference teams. Denver at 5. Dallas is actually at 6. They don't have their draft pick, so there's no reason for them to tank. Houston's at 7, Minnesota 8, Clippers 9. Sacramento is negative in the last 10 games despite trying to hold on for the playoffs. Pelicans are just going through whatever they're going through. Spurs are miserable recently. The worst defensive team in the last 10 games is the Spurs, followed by the Lakers. Spurs are allowing 120 points per 100 possessions over their last 10 games. 0-4 on the rodeo road trip. Really not defending. Denver's defense is 23rd in the last 10 games. Houston's is 21st. Teams having a hard time scoring that matter. Sacramento is 24th offensively. Take a quick check of the standings. A few different, obviously, ways to look at the standings, but just right now the Jazz are sitting at 6th. They're a half game behind Houston. That loss to Houston at home is just a killer. Portland is at 4th, a game and a half up. Thunder have stretched out, so has Denver. Does feel like, barring something ridiculous, Denver and Oklahoma City are the 2-3, Warriors are 1, and then who's going to sneak into 4 to get home court? And then who's going to sneak into 8 and 9? Clippers are in 8 right now and not clear that they want to be there. Sacramento is at 9, San Antonio's at 7 and sliding fast, and the Lakers are at 10. And Dallas is 4 games out, so I think they're probably out, but they're looking at it. Home, road wins minus home losses. This point of the season, everyone's about the same. You can get some insight. Golden State's 12. Denver's 10. OKC is 10. Portland is 2. Houston is 4. Jazz are 4. Spurs are 3. Clippers are 4. Kings are even. Lakers are even. Dallas is minus 2. So that's interesting. Portland at 2 only. Rockets at 4. Jazz at 4. Spurs at 3. Clippers at 4. Every team in the Western Conference playoff race other than the Lakers and the Spurs are above 500 in their last 10. And the final thing to look at is the projection systems. Let's see where they have everybody. The playoff push will be upon us. Golden State, ESPN, we'll look at ESPN 538 in basketball reference. ESPN has Golden State 1, Denver 2, OKC 3, Utah 4, Houston 5, Portland 6, San Antonio 8, Clippers 9. Wait a sec. I got that wrong. Houston 5, Portland 6, San Antonio 7, Clippers 8, with a huge drop. Sacramento and LA, they both still have under 500 with a 5 game. They don't even have a playoff race. They have a heck of a race between 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 4 games separating 4 through 8. Don't really have much of a race for 3, 4. 538, which is very similar. Nice article, by the way, on Lindsey Vonn on 538, if anyone is interested in it. 538 has the projected records as Warriors 1, Nuggets 2, tied with the Thunder, Rockets 4, Jazz 5, Blazers 6, Spurs 7, Clippers 8 by one game over the Lakers, and 3 games over the Kings. So they have less separation. And Basketball Reference has Warriors 1, Nuggets by a game over the Thunder 2-3, Portland 4, Jazz 5, Rockets 6, San Antonio 7, Clippers 8. Who would you rather see in the first round, Houston or Portland? Seems like the two teams that we're most likely going to play at this point. I'll let you chew on that. Still got a ways to go in an All-Star break. Warriors tomorrow. We'll come to you live from San Francisco for the show tomorrow morning. Thanks to Slow the Flow and to Iron Gate Global Advisors. This is Locked On Jazz. Now tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On NBA and get the biggest stories from the local experts on the Locked On Podcast Network.